Thank you for joining us for Bryant's Faculty Spotlight. I'm your host, Sam Simas, the Digital Services and Research Librarian in the Krupp Library. And during this podcast, I'm going to take you inside the minds of Bryant University's faculty, where we'll talk about their innovative projects, their successes, and the challenges they've met. On this episode, I sat down with Dr. Brian Blaze, a professor in the Science and Technology Department, to learn how he created an open textbook, Statistical Inference for Everyone, that presents a no-to-low-cost alternative to conventional textbooks. So, Brian, thanks for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Good, good. I'm glad that you're here to talk to us a little bit about your work, some of the projects that you're working on. I'm particularly interested in a project that you've done called Statistical Inference for Everyone. But first, I want to ask you a little bit about how you got involved teaching and what your background is.
So, I have a background in physics. I have a bachelor's in physics from Wesleyan University in Connecticut, and then a PhD from Brown University. And at Brown, I did work in computational neuroscience, so looking at how to understand how the brain works, learning and memory from computational models of neurons. And this is within the physics department, so we're approaching it differently than, say, a biologist would in that. So at Brown, as part of your physics degree, you are responsible for TAing some of the physics labs. And even at that time, I was interested in teaching, and I would look for ways to kind of connect to the students and help them with various topics. And I wrote these homemade guides for various topics, which are essentially supplemental to whatever their textbook was, to go over anything that was particularly confusing for them. And I realize I still have those, on my website. You can always get, you can go back to, the 90s and find my these homemade guides I wrote when I was a graduate student.
That's pretty cool. Are these, do you think that they're still applicable to some of the things that you teach today?
I have actually used some of them. Like one of the ones I know on circuits, I've used for my class just last year. Oh. So it was kind of definitely reusing something that's been around for a while. I started at Bryant in 2000. And so I teach here, I teach physics, I teach astronomy, artificial intelligence and robotics, computational neuroscience. I've taught dynamical systems and machine learning. So a lot of different things. But I guess the overall theme of what I teach is kind of quantitative methods and kind of way to think in science.
Tell me a little bit more about some of the classes, because you gave me a lot of information about the kinds of classes that you're teaching.
Well, actually, I don't teach any of the statistics classes. This is one thing that kind of interests about the project that you mentioned, the Statistical Inference for Everyone. So that was a textbook that I wrote in a sense to prove a point. So it's kind of an odd motivation perhaps, but so there are two schools of thought about statistical inference. One is what is traditionally called frequentist or orthodox, and the other, which is traditionally called Bayesian. And I found over time that the Bayesian approach seemed to me to be the correct one, and it occupies a kind of a strange position in mathematics or statistics in that none of the introductory classes use that approach. So even though you can show that most of the successes in statistical inference of the past decade, things like use of automatic driving cars to the forecast for political elections, they all use Bayesian methods, and yet none of the introductory classes use them. And so when I approached mathematics professors, and I taught some of this probability theory in physics class, I've definitely taught it in machine learning class, and so I taught pieces of these things, but just not as a standalone statistics class. And so when I approached the stat professors and math professors about this, there seems to be a historical kind of various reasons why this is not typically done. And there are a number of reasons given. So I just decided, I'm going to write my own textbook to kind of show how it could be done. I mean, there may be better ways to do it, or other people could do it, whatever, but just as a proof of concept to say, here's how we could do an introductory statistics class from a Bayesian point of view, and I'm going to write a textbook to kind of show how that would be done. And it also helped to kind of clear my head about kind of all the ideas and make that kind of clear myself by kind of giving a clear progression and what would the logic of a class like that be.
Right, and so one of the things that's unique about statistical inference for everyone is that it's an open educational resource. So it's kind of in the spirit of those classroom manuals that you were making for your students during your grad program.
Yes.
Could you tell me a little bit about why you decided to make an open educational resource instead of a traditional textbook?
Yeah, so one of the reasons is that I was anticipating some pushback from traditional publishers, given that there really hasn't been an incentive clearly to have an intro statistics book from a Bayesian point of view. So I would expect that. Second is I wanted to make sure that the barrier to entry for anyone was as low as possible. So someone would not have an excuse to not at least look at it, right? Which I think could happen. And then I was also motivated by a few other open education resources that I had seen, one of which is from Alan Downey in Olin College. And he has a book on statistical inference, but it's more for kind of undergraduate engineers, so it focuses most on programming. And so it's a slightly different audience than I was thinking of. And then another open education resource that I've used in my physics class, which is the Light and Matter series by Ben Crowell, and that one again is kind of showed me the value of making a product and kind of putting it out there so that anyone can have access to it.
Were there any challenges that you faced when you were making this book?
I mean, I would say just the normal challenges of writing a textbook, obviously, in terms of motivation and time and things like that. I think if you're doing the traditional publishing route, you may have editors or a publisher kind of breathing down your neck on deadlines, which of course have to be self-imposed when you do something like this. So in those cases, there was that. And then technically, there were things like, because you have to do all your own formatting and stuff like that. I find that stuff kind of fun, but there's obviously a challenge trying to learn how to do that.
Sure. Yeah, I'm sure that it's this kind of pioneering project that you get to explore a lot of different things with,
You have a lot of control, but then again, you have control, right? You have to, take the controls.
Right. And were you working alone on the project?
I was working alone on the project, although I did do it through a number of the writing retreats that they offer here for the faculty and staff. And so, the people in the writing center were instrumental in helping me edit it over, over a number of years, of the writing retreats, and that was fantastic.
Could you tell us a little bit about how this textbook, or how you think this textbook has impacted your students in their ability to, participate in class or access research or these concepts in a more general way?
So I use this textbook, pieces of it in different classes. And one of the things that happens is a problem might come out in, say, physics lab, where we're doing, and a question will come up like, how many data points do I need to take, or how do I do this particular analysis that might not be in the book, right? So then I can add it to the book right then and there, and then have an update. And so the students have access, essentially, to this kind of moving, growing target of this book that then adjusts based on what problems we're having to deal with. And so I think that's really valuable. And also just to see that process of any textbook is incomplete, and here's how we can fix it or make it more complete or at least more relevant to this particular case.
It sounds like it's a really flexible, dynamic kind of format for you to continue. So
absolutely,
it's not a fixed thing, although,
And that was another reason why I wanted to do it as an open education resource, is because the turnaround time, if someone wants an addition or I want to add an example or a problem or fix typo or whatever, the time between me doing the fix and someone being able to get a print copy of the updated version is about 2 or 3 days. And that turnaround time, I think, is pretty much impossible with traditional publishing.
Oh, absolutely. Did they, and this is just for my own personal interest, did they impose any kind of version control on it that you can see, like, this is, revision number 72, hopefully?
I would say I do that myself, in terms of dating. There's nothing, with independent publishing, there's nothing that is saying you have to do it any particular way or any particular version. Some people like to put out a version every time there's a change. Some people like to kind of build up all the changes for a while and then do a bigger, version change you know, after a while. This is true also for software development. So some of the software that I develop for classrooms, you do updates, bug fixes, and so on, and there's this kind of this ongoing process for doing that.
What would you say to your colleagues who are interested in making this kind of resource?
I would say, you know, try it, you know, and look at, you know, just experiment, you know, see what works, see what's out there, and so on. I mean, I think a lot of, you know, of my colleagues are hesitant to even use open, you know, resources, in which case I say kind of, you know, give it a go, you know, experiment a little bit. The academia has this really nice rhythm to it of semesters, where if something doesn't work as well as you would like, the next semester you can start from you know, fresh start and go from there. So there's not much of a downside to trying something out. And I would say, you know, anyone who's trying to, you know, write something like this, I would say start small, like, you know, do little things, or maybe contribute to one of the other open education, you know, resources, things like OpenStax or some other, you know, textbook series that, you know, where they may have some expertise and try that, just to kind of, you know, get a sense for where it might go if they're not familiar with it at all. I think there's often a thought that the open access materials are of a lower quality than those that go through a traditional publisher. And I would say there's probably a lot more variation. I mean, that there is some stuff that's not really, you know, that high quality, but there's some stuff that's very high quality. And it takes some effort to kind of sift through it. So as they see, it's kind of a matter of time, you know, why, you know, spending that time to sift through that, you know, it presents somewhat of a barrier. So I think, like with most things, that probably the easiest way to do that is to find people that you respect who use it, and then pull it in. Or it might be from another institution, or someone within the institution from a different, you know, area, just to bring that out.
Are there any sources that you trust for finding that kind of information, or any ways that you?
I just look. You know, as I say, yeah. That, yeah, and I just, you know, look around. You know, you can Google, you know, the kind of open access, and then, you know, physics textbooks or whatever, and then you kind of sift through. And I can always, you can usually tell from a pretty quick glance which one, you know, which ones are better or not. And occasionally I've done experiments. So for instance, in astronomy, there were two that seemed to come out. There was one called Astronomy Notes, and then another one called from the OpenStax Astronomy. And so for the students, because there's no cost for them, I presented them with both. And then I gave readings for a few weeks with both of them. And then after a few weeks, asked them, which one do you prefer and why? And so that helped. And there actually turned out in that case to be a clear winner. Surprisingly, it was the one that allowed you to have a single PDF download, as opposed to a kind of a website with kind of hyperlinks and flexible. And I would have thought the opposite, because you would think that the students would be more like the kind of flexibility. But I think they liked being able to read it on e-readers and other technology, and that's harder to do if it's not kind of a self-contained document. So there were those, you know, and there were other kind of content-related things. But that was one of the items that came up.
So I want to transition a little bit into questions that are a bit more personal, right? So
sure.
What has been the most enjoyable aspect of working on a project like this for you?
For me, I think it's coming up with interesting examples that really highlight a particular topic but are entertaining. So for example, in the statistics book, I have an example with a psychic octopus. There was Paul, yes, I should say allegedly psychic octopus, I should probably say.
It's even better.
and so it was Paul the octopus. He was a German octopus who predicted World Cup matches, and you can read his Wikipedia page on that. Octopi don't typically live all that long, so he lived for about 4 or 5 years, something like that. But he got, out of his 14 predictions, he got 12 right, which is phenomenal for if you think that the process is totally random. And so I use this to introduce the idea of probability of rare events and also multiple hypotheses. So, you know, we're not just left with, say, you know, a randomly choosing octopus and a psychic octopus, right? You know, there might be other things going on. I mean, and so those sorts of examples are both kind of entertaining, which makes them memorable, but it also really highlights particular problems in there. So that's the kind of thing that I like to do. in one of my software packages that I use, something called that I've written, something called Pindamics, which does looks at dynamical systems, and one of the systems it looked at was diseases. So someone getting infected by a disease and then recovering, kind of like influenza, right? So there are these standard models for modeling the dynamics of influenza during a season, like, you know, the increase and decrease and how fast and how many and so on. And a student and I we used this package that I wrote, and we applied it to zombie movies. So instead of, it's the same exact model, all the math is identical, and you can show, you know, the same sorts of dynamics in, you know, Shaun of the Dead and, you know, 28 Days Later and so on, but and then as you do for influenza or whatever. And so it's that sort of thing, kind of coming up with something that is, you know, both kind of captivating for the students, but also it's not dumbing it down at all. It's just, you know, a little bit more interesting. And I find that part of it a lot of fun. And that's kind of part of teaching is, you know, how do you connect to students, you know, using movies and things like that is, I find it very helpful.
Yeah, sure. Do you plan on taking any of those connections, you know, into new projects with you? What do you have planned for the future?
Oh, well, okay. So if we're talking about the zombies, I actually have kind of percolating this idea of extending it to werewolves and vampires as well. and there you get interesting things like, you know, diseases that might have a seasonality, which would be kind of like werewolves that have, like, you know, following the moon. You know, diseases don't typically follow the moon, but they follow possibly the yearly cycle, right? So it's the same kind of cyclical sort of thing. You have something like vampires where you might have a disease that may lay dormant for certain amounts of time or have a small number of people who are infected, right? And the dynamics can be very different if you're dealing with a large population versus a small one. And so we have to deal with kind of like the randomness of that. And that connects to some of the work I do on chemical dynamics, for some of my research projects. So that's this one idea that, you know, I think specifically, you know, extending that, you know, that one project.
So I have a literature background. Have you ever considered working with someone in, you know, the English or Cultural Studies department to do a kind of like hybrid, like epidemiological survey of Frankenstein or something? Like, oh, I guess not Frankenstein, but maybe Dracula, something weird like that.
I had not thought of that, but I'm always open to any kind of ideas. I imagine that there'd be some interesting things, you know, from the literature where you might be able to, you know, track certain dynamics and so on. But I do have a project where I actually applied that model to Twitter hashtags, and so we look at the kind of infectiousness of ideas, right?
That's fascinating.
And then you get the same kind of dynamics as well with that, and you can kind of measure some ideas as being more infectious than others.
What kinds of ideas were more, like, what did you find?
It also will depend on the time period that we're doing, but this was a few years ago, and so there was like World Cup going on, and so you'd get these spikes based on the certain players or certain teams that came up that would spread very rapidly, but then they would dissipate very rapidly because they would be across only, you know, the time scale of a game or so. And so you get those sorts of like kind of really short-term dynamics, but then you'd also get these political ones which would, you know, they would be kind of a slower rise, but they would last longer.
Can you give an example of a time that you've failed and maybe used that failure to kind of propel you forward?
One of them was in applying to grad school. So senior year, applying to grad school, I applied to about 6 different schools. In hindsight, did a terrible job with the applications because I was like, you know, working on my thesis, I was doing a bunch of classes, too busy. I didn't get in anywhere. So that was pretty demoralizing, actually. So my advisor set me up with a job to go after the summer. Just before I was supposed to go, that lab had a major accident, which then, you know, no one was hurt, but it sucked up my whole salary. So then I had to do temp work, you know, in the summer in my, you know, hometown for a while. And so, you know, things didn't seem to be going very well. But the year off got me one. I found that I did want to go back to school, right? So it wasn't just doing it just because. And so I was studying more and things like that. But it gave me the time to, like, you know, to write better essays, to do a much more thorough job on my applications, to way ahead of time, ask for letters of recommendation, so then those letters were much better because they weren't rushed, they weren't forced or anything like that. And the second time around, I pretty much got in everywhere, including Brown, which is where I went. So that was one of those cases where the initial failure kind of put me in a position where I had to kind of reevaluate, but it gave me the space in order to deal with, like, okay, now what do I need to do to succeed? And that was, I would say, you know, one of my major kind of failures turned to success.
Is there any particular nugget in there that you would give to students as advice?
Well, I mean, there I would just say, you know, even when it looks bleak, there's, you know, always opportunities and always to look for that and take advantage of. I mean, if you've lost an opportunity, that provides you some time to find another one, right? You know, or to reevaluate. I mean, it could have been the case that having not gotten in anywhere, after a while been like, yo, you know what, I don't really need to go back to school for this, or I could go back to school for something else, but it gives you the space to do that. So don't think it's the end of the world, you know, for, you know, if something doesn't go your way. I mean, there's a lot of ways things can go right.
Right, so apparent failure is not always failure in the way that we think it might
right.
be.
Right, and you have to, you know, think about the long game, really.
Yeah. Is there any kind of advice that you think students should ignore?
I would say ignore anything that tells them that they're going to fail or that something, you know, might not work. Hey, it's true, something might not work, but try it anyway. You know, I mean, that's, you know, that's going to be life. You're going to do many things, some of which will work, some of them won't work. But if you, you know, don't do it, then you'll never really know.
I mean, you're a scientist, so that's like in your bones. You know?
Yeah,
you have to try it.
Experiment, try it and see if it works.
That's,
I guess,
right.
Yes.
Let's see. So do you have any unusual habits or absurd things that you like to do?
Oh, that's an interesting question. So I am a big Babylon 5 fan.
What is Babylon 5?
Okay, so I was going to say that because a lot of people will not know what that reference is. So Babylon 5 is a science fiction show from the 1990s. It ran from about 1993 to 1998. And I would say that show paved the way for many shows in the future, including Game of Thrones, which has had obviously a recent conclusion and so on. At the time that Babylon 5 aired, producers pretty much thought that audiences were incapable of following a story for more than 3 episodes. And Babylon 5 was the first TV series that had a 5-year planned story arc. So it was planned from the beginning to go 5 years like a novel and have like a climax somewhere around, you know, season 4 and finish in season 5. And so there are things in season 1 that refer to seasons later on. And it's a cumulative story. And that one show kind of spoiled me for so many other shows that don't have a plan, and it was really the kind of the first one. And so I've seen that show many, many times. And now that I really don't watch TV much, I took the audio off of the copies I have, so I can listen to it in the car like an audiobook. And so, yeah, I guess that's a little unusual, perhaps a little obsessive, but it really is a very good show.
I've never heard of anybody ripping the audio from a show and listening to it like a book.
Yeah,
what's that like?
Yeah. So we do it for our kids for musicals. So it's really useful because we don't have a TV or DVD player in a car, but for long car rides, Disney movies and things like that. You know, there are musicals that, you know, you just listen to the movie because they have the music in between and so on. You just imagine what it is. Not a lot of shows work very well. I tried it once for Harry Potter, and it doesn't work all that well because so much of it is visual, at least for Harry Potter. But with at least with Babylon 5, so much of the storyline is driven by dialogue. But also, I had seen the series so many times before when I had recorded it onto VHS tapes. It kind of goes back to, you know, how old that is, and I had the entire collection of VHS tapes, you know, from TV. So I knew kind of visually what it looked like anyway. So it wouldn't be something that you would do without having seen it, but it's a pretty good, you know, kind of once you know what it looks like, the storyline still works pretty well.
Our last question for today is, what do you do when you're feeling unfocused?
Most of the time when I feel like I'm unfocused is because I'm distracted by stuff. You know, delete stuff off of phones, take all social media off. I usually give up all social media within for a month or so in the spring anyway. I block it on my laptop. I do that sort of thing. Go back to basics, analog, write things down by hand, that kind of stuff. I find that helps me make it a little bit more concrete, but also helps me really focus on what I need to do at that point and so on.
Sounds like you're setting the reset button.
Yes.
You're hitting the reset button.
Yeah.
And it works.
It does work pretty well. And going back to analog really helps. Getting away from the computers and for someone who does as much tech stuff as I do and everything else, it's kind of surprising. But my organizer is a bullet journal, and so it's an actual physical journal that I write in pen and so on. And I find that helps me focus and get away from stuff.
Do you feel like there's a benefit of writing with your hand instead of typing?
I think so, yes. Yeah. Yes, there's something a little bit more concrete there. It also has a built-in almost prioritization. So with bullet journaling, once you fill up a journal, you copy all the stuff to another one, right? And if you find yourself copying something multiple times that you've been procrastinating, you start evaluating, do I really need to do this? Am I procrastinating it because it's just procrastination or because it really doesn't need to be done? And so you have this built-in, method of reevaluation. Before I did that, I used to switch to-do apps. So I would go from Wunderlist to Doist to To-Do to whatever, and I'd just jump from one to another, and then just copy everything over from one to the other one, and that was my reset.
Because I've done that a number of times with the different apps. To-Doist and Wunderlist. Many times.
And I realized but I've been able to keep my a bullet journal now for about a year and a half, which is longer. I've been able to keep any app specifically. So
the analog works for you?
Analog works very well.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
And it's actually something surprising. The students, it seems, they have analog planners. Their calendars are analog, which surprised me. I would have thought that students now would be all about the digital tools, but it seems like they like their analog planners.
Well, Brian, thanks for chatting with us today about your work and about some of the projects that you have going on in the future and about zombies and about psychic octopi.
Yeah.
Incredible. Thanks.
Thanks
for tuning into Bryant's Faculty Spotlight, a production made possible through the partnership of the Bryant University Library and University Relations. Thanks to John Fonseca for his audiovisual wizardry and to Dr. Brian Blaze for sharing his work. And don't forget to check out his book, Statistical Inference for Everyone. Each episode, we explore faculty projects, publications, and personalities. Subscribe to keep track of the work that inspires us to excel. If you're interested in being featured, then shoot me an email at ssimons2@bryant.edu.